I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and visit our show archives at tvtimemachine.com.
You can't help me. What do you know?
All sorts of things. You really only pretend to like skiing, right?
Yes.
But you're pleased that your best friend recently gained some weight, about 10 pounds. You wish you'd been more adventurous when you were younger. You love India, but you've never been there. You have trouble sleeping. Your favorite color is blue.
I don't understand. You're psychic.
No. Just paying attention. I used to make a good living pretending to be a psychic. I tell you this because I want you to understand there's no point hiding things from me.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to embark on a journey through a vast galaxy that traverses memory, generations, and popular culture. A magical trip through time as we meet the men and women of yesterday and today who have shaped not only what we see on TV, but the way we see ourselves. I'm Jim Benson. Join me, if you will, on an exploration of television's past, present, and future as we climb aboard the TV Time Machine. Our destination subject today will be the CBS psychological crime drama, The Mentalist. Creator and producer of The Mentalist, Bruno Heller, will join us for a fascinating excursion examining this extraordinary modern-day TV classic. We'll begin our exciting and fun-filled odyssey right after these brief messages.
I was born Mary Tyler Moore.
It's Jesse Donald Knotts.
Fred McFeely Rogers.
Leslie Moonves.
Isabel Sanford.
Leslie Renee Stahl.
Robert Edward Turner.
Regis Francis Philbin.
Aaron Spelling.
Since 1999, the Archive of American Television has been preserving the memories, knowledge, and insights of the men and women whose talents and vision have helped shape this remarkable medium. Over 500 video interviews with these TV legends are now available on the Archive of American Television website at metvlegends.org. There, you can sign up to receive news, updates, and also become a sponsor to help preserve television history for generations to come. That's metvlegends.org.
The mythological proportions of Star Trek provide something that's missing in people's consciousness, psyche.
The Archive of American Television. Capturing television history, one voice at a time. Today on the TV Time Machine, we ask you to concentrate for the next hour as we focus on a remarkable television series. In this edition of our program, we are proud to welcome creator and executive producer of The Mentalist, Bruno Heller. Mr. Heller has been at the helm of this exceptional drama since 2008 and previously served as producer and writer on the acclaimed HBO series, Rome. Over the next few segments, Bruno Heller will help us explore virtually every aspect of this remarkable series, whose season premiere airs September 30th at 10 p.m. on CBS as we probe the psyches of Patrick Jane, Red John, and the CBI team. Again, for those of you intrepid enough to sit down for a reading, feel free to put on your thinking caps as we release ourselves from the past to experience a most perspicacious present. Bruno, thank you for coming on board the TV Time Machine.
Great pleasure. Glad to be with you.
Bruno, you were born and raised in England.
Yes.
Now, as a young lad, were your ambitions always geared toward the creative arts?
I guess so. As a young lad, a young one, I think I probably lost the plot a bit in my teens. Got distracted by other things. But my father was a screenwriter, so it was always one of the options out there, certainly.
Now, your dad wrote several movies. What did he write?
He worked for a long time with Robert Aldrich. He wrote The Dirty Dozen, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, Flight of the Phoenix, Killing a Sister George. He was a prolific guy.
Now, did he particularly want you to pursue writing, or was he kind of neutral on the subject?
No, not at all. In fact, when I first mentioned that I might want to try it, he gave me in reply, he gave me an essay that I think it was Raymond Chandler wrote about writing for Hollywood, which was very discouraging because, you know, it's a tough world for screenwriters, certainly the feature business. That's the world that he was discouraging me from. Much, I think, you know, if you're an actor, a lot of actors don't really want their kids to become actors for similar reasons. It's a tough life with a lot of rejection and insecurity. So, you know, although he was successful, it's not a life you would wish on your children necessarily.
Were there, over the years, besides your father's work, films or filmmakers that particularly inspired you?
Yeah, sure. As a teenager, I loved, I think the first movie that I really sparked to was called Kez by Ken Loach, which is about a young boy and who finds a kestrel chick and raises it. It's kind of kitchen sink northern realism, but beautiful little movie. And I remember seeing that, I guess, when I was about 13 and really being deeply impressed by it. Not to the degree that I said, you know, I've got to be a filmmaker or a writer, but just, you know, that was I think it was impressive to me because it was both epic and dramatic and moving, but very small and real and simple. I still like that kind of combination.
Did you watch much television when you were...
Not so much because in England in the 60s and 70s, there were only three channels, as they were called. And most of what was on was not particularly geared to young people anyway. So there'd be one or two shows that you could watch every day, but for the most part, it's a different world. It's hard to imagine that lack of TV. And I think to a degree, it's a good thing because you pay attention. There's very little sort of just staring at the TV in a hypnotic way because there wasn't enough TV to hypnotize you. I guess I did a lot more reading than watching TV as a kid.
So there weren't particular shows that captivated you, like shows like The Saint, The Prisoner, that aired at the time?
Let's see. As a kid, Minder was an English show I used to love. At that time, drama was very much a kind of BBC Masterpiece Theatre end of the spectrum. So stuff that a teenager would like was quite rare. Later on, I admired a series called Boys from the Black Stuff by Leesdale. Again, kind of very real social realism, but with strong dramatic characters and a kind of sense of epic tragedy, although about ordinary working class people. What else? American shows were always a fabulous treat for all the obvious reasons, sunshine and beautiful people and high production values. Hawaii Five-O, I think, as a kid was a show I loved. Do you remember a show called Branded?
Oh, yes, with Chuck Connors.
Chuck Connors, yeah. I could still sing you that tune. and also, I think, you know, strangely, different shows were popular there than in America. There was a show called Alias Smith and Jones.
Oh, yes, with Pete Duell and Ben Murphy.
Yeah, wow, you're good. which was a big hit in England, less so here. I loved that show.
Now, you worked in British film production. Are there primary differences between how films are made in Britain and the United States?
Or there certainly used to be. I started in sound. I was a sound man in that capacity, a boom op, which is actually a great training for cinema and TV writing, oddly. Well, to give you an example, one of the first couple of things I did, one time I was doing a gas board commercial, you know, the most kind of bottom line cheap PSA type of thing, you know, if you smell gas, switch off the light. And the director was Nick Rogue, and the lighting cameraman was Barry Unsworth, because, you know, even the top English guys had to take what they could get and would work on anything that came through. So it was a much less kind of glamorous, show-busy kind of business, the English business. And the other side of it is much more hierarchical. When I was working on, for instance, Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn with Maggie Smith, I was boom up on that. You had to call the director sir, and you were instructed never to talk to any of the actors.
Wow.
It was very, not military, but certainly the old school English class system was still very much a part of the scene in those days. I imagine it's changed now, but I haven't worked in the English business for a good 20 years or so now, 20, 30 years.
Well, in terms of English television productions, in England they make fewer episodes per season when it comes to their TV shows.
Yeah.
Would that be something that you would prefer? Do you think that that's actually better, or does it not matter?
Oh, sure, it matters. I mean, that, it's a simple sort of mathematical, you know, time is of the essence. And, for instance, on The Mentalist, we do 24 episodes a year in essentially a nine-month shooting schedule, which means there is no leeway for error. It's almost like improv, or it's much more like speed chess than chess, whereas even going down to 12, which, for instance, I did on Rome, it means that each episode gets that much more time and attention spent on it. I don't think that difference is so distinct with, you know, what you might call populist entertainment, because, you know what you're doing in the first place, and you're kind of producing something to a recipe, whereas more complex shows, you know, a show like Sopranos, for instance, just to take one example, much tougher to get the kind of nuance and subtlety and moral ambivalence and depth in a show like that. If you were having to produce 24, it would inevitably become much more shticky and much more of a kind of mafia comedy drama, just because time and effort and frankly, you know, there aren't that many great writers around. So, and I don't include myself amongst those either. So, you know, 24 episodes is that much harder to produce than 12 for all those reasons.
Now, when you created The Mentalist, was there a particular inspiration? How did the genesis of The Mentalist come about?
I guess the initial spark was I had been working for HBO, and I was moving to Warner Brothers under development deal, and it, with very much the remit to create a popular network show. And so the first thing to do was to find, I don't like to sort of do retreads or copies of other things. I think I've, once in my life I've written an adaptation of something else, of someone else's material, and I couldn't really spark to it. So it was important to me to find something, a core idea that was no one else had done before, in quite that form, as opposed to doing a straight cop procedural where it's about the execution and the sort of who you hire and what that kind of character is. It was important to find something fresh. So I was churning through ideas, and it, one of the odd things about coming to America from England is that England is a much more skeptical, cynical, agnostic society. Until I moved to America, I hadn't really met anyone religious. And I married an American who is, like a lot of women, in fact, more than men, is, you know, believes in the spirit world and would go to psychics. And that confounded me, frankly, because I couldn't quite understand, you know, what the impulse was and why she would believe someone sitting in a storefront on Olympic Boulevard, you know, with a crystal ball. And then I noticed that practically every block in the city of Los Angeles, and the same is true of New York, and the same is true of London, and Toronto, and, you know, anywhere you go in the world, Peking, Buenos Aires, there is the psychics. It's a kind of vast, vast underworld economy that is kind of invisible to the, whatever you'd want to call it, the mainstream world. People go to them a great deal and rely on them for a kind of folk healing, if you like.
Right, same thing with astrology and that sort of thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And what occurred to me was, being a skeptic about this and looking into the techniques they use, is these are charlatans, in essence. It's very difficult to be a good psychic without knowing that you're faking, because you have to kind of use logic and observation and pay close attention to, you know, the technique involves a lot of self-awareness. So whilst there are certainly many psychics who genuinely believe they are psychic, most of them are doing a kind of complex theatrical shtick, charlatans in other words. But at the same time, the good ones are performing the same kind of functions as good psychoanalysts and good priests. and good doctors and you know, good counselors. So obviously, some of them are just there to rip people off, but that's true of any kind of profession like that. So there was this great kind of ambivalence about that world. If you're a good mentalist, which is the sort of founding skills of psychic readings and stuff, if you're a good mentalist, then you have great empathy for people and great understanding and great intelligence and the gift of the gab, and you have to have charm and people have to like you and people want to have to confide in you, but at the same time you're lying to them in order to make your living but helping them at the same time. So for a TV character, you need to have some kind of, it makes it much more interesting if there is some core contradiction in the character. So looking into that world and realizing that a lot of the skills of a mentalist are the same kind of skills that a detective employs, you know, observation, cold reading, a really kind of sharp and predatory understanding of human nature, human psychology. Mentalists and detectives share those skills. So, and then once I got into reading, you know, mentalist literature, the actual techniques they employ are great fun and would translate beautifully to TV. And then it was simply a question of, all right, how do you take this essentially roguish charlatan character and put him in a procedural where he is, you know, working for good, hence the backstory and everything else that follows. But really, I have to say that the initial idea turned out to be a good one, but the real spark of the show, what really made it work, is Simon. Because what the show requires, and it was always clear that it did require that, the first, you know, even in the first discussions with Warner Brothers, it had to be either a star of great charisma or someone who was not a star, who hadn't been discovered, who had that charisma in them and that grace. In Simon Baker, we have an extremely graceful and talented actor who exudes a joie de vivre and a sort of spirit and positivity and joy. That's in itself, regardless of scripts and stories and production value, is an amazing real quality that comes across to audiences, and that's essentially what makes the show work and what makes it popular. The characters can be a bastard, and the characters can be intrusive and mean and insolent and disruptive. And in order to do that, he has to be charming nonetheless. He has to have a sort of overpowering sense of, an overpowering attractiveness that you want to be in the room with him anyway. And to a degree, that's the TV is on some level. You're watching other people, so you want them to be interesting and attractive and charming and welcoming. And Baker had that in spades, and immediately, because he is someone with that charm and that handsomeness and beauty even, but, you know, he has his own demons and his own dark side, so he immediately related to the character, and we had to have very little horse trading about who the character was or how to portray him, because he immediately got it.
Well, I think your character is one of the most complex, really, in the history of television, because there are times, obviously, Patrick Jane goes over the line, and there are times that, even though you've been watching him for many, many years, there's so much ambiguity in the character that you sometimes question for a moment, what side is he really on sometimes, and then he pulls back.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I think that's true of all, not just the characters, actors, kind of, you know, fictional characters. If it's very hard to sustain or sustain interest in someone who is unrelentingly good, because we kind of recognize that without really knowing why. That's not real. No one is like that. You can't look into the lives of the greatest saints without finding dark shadows and ambivalence.
Mm-hmm. Even Mother Teresa had problems.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's a very good example of someone who, you know, had lost all her faith, but had enough kind of love left in her soul that she still operated, for good or ill, the way she always had, because she knew that it was more important to carry on doing what she was doing than to lay out that loss of faith, which is a kind of courage. And that courage, that same courage in the character of Patrick Jane, that willingness to go on and make the best of life, although to some degree he feels that his life is over, that's where the heroism of the character is, and that's why he can do terrible things or very kind of morally ambiguous things, because his heroism is not in his virtue, it's in his willingness to persevere and his willingness to carry on and his determination not to let anyone see that he's suffering.
Well, also, I think there's heroism in the fact that he tries to maintain a positive attitude and humor when things are most dire.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a kind of, and I think for lack of a more coherent religious principle in my life, that would be it. That, you know, we're here anyway, whether we like it or not. And life does go on. So you might as well carry on with humor and life and positivity, because, you know, the alternative is not better.
Bruno, we're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but never fear. I'll be back in a lightning flash with Bruno Heller, creator-producer of The Mentalist, whose season premiere airs Sunday, September 30th at 10 p.m. on CBS, who is riding along with us on the TV Time Machine.